Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
It's just a total deflection, this whole thing with Russia. What do I have to get involved with Putin for? I have nothing to do with Putin. I've never spoken to him. I don't know anything about him other than he will respect me.
Yes, well, a question being raised with increasing frequency. What is going on with Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin? And while we're up that way, is it possible that Putin is planning to upstage another Olympics by invading another neighbouring country? My guests Robin Lustig and Tom Rivers will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including a right-wing German political party suggests forcibly relocating undesirables. What could possibly go wrong, etc. and...
There was watered-down walls, also electricity short-circuiting. That is when the Australians made the decision that our athletes would not be moving into the village until these problems were fixed.
While guests at the Rio Games have at least been spared the obviously appalling prospect of Australian neighbours, what are the pitfalls of deciding who rooms next to whom? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Robin Lustig, journalist, broadcaster and former presenter of The World Tonight on Radio 4, among many, many others, and Tom Rivers, correspondent for ABC News Radio in London. Welcome both. Now, it is a little over 8 years since the Olympic women's beach volleyball arena in Beijing became an unlikely battlefield when a match between Russia and Georgia descended into rancor related to the invasion of the former by the latter back in the real world. 8 years later, Metaphor correspondents at the Rio Games are on high alert as Russian forces mass ominously on the border separating occupied Crimea from the rest of Ukraine. Robin, first of all, this story has been bubbling away for a few days now. What would Putin gain from further intervention in Ukraine that he doesn't already have?
I think there's a couple of things that he might very well be interested in. First of all, there's the politics. He's got elections, parliamentary elections, coming up next month.
These aren't really going to be an up-all-night nail-biter, though, are they?
Well, he would like to get a really good vote. Things in Russia are not great at the moment, and he does not want his party's support to be seen to be falling. Overseas interventions is always good electoral politics. That's number one. Secondly, there are the ongoing spluttering talks, the so-called Minsk process, which is meant to find some kind of solution to the Russia-Ukraine issue. It's not doing very well. If he can strengthen his hand ahead of the next round of those talks, that is good. What he really wants, I think, is a land corridor of some kind that links the Crimea with the rest of Russia as he would see it, and that means getting a little bit more power over a little bit more of Ukraine.
Tom, there's an obvious background of opportunity that Putin would be able to perceive here. Not only are there the Olympics, the US is basically now on hold until November. Mm-hmm. Europe is now on hold until God knows when as it attempts to figure out how the UK can get out of it. Given all that, however, would this be the best... If you are Vladimir Putin, I'm putting you in charge of Russia, Russia for the next 60 seconds or so, would this be the best imaginable use of your resources?
I don't know about the best use, but timing-wise, it seems like a very opportune time because America's distracted with its own domestic affairs. And as you say, Europe every day, it's the question of the day. What is the relationship between the UK and Europe as that marches on? Oh, yes. Remember what happened in the Ukraine. And we're still, you know, oh, yeah, what is happening now? It is off the front pages. And Rand, if you want to do something, you do something now.
The thing about Putin, I think, Andrew, is that he understands power and how to use it. The Georgia thing worked pretty well from his point of view. The annexation of Crimea worked pretty well from his point of view. As Tom says, Europe is in a mess now. The US is obsessed with a presidential election. When better than for Putin to say, hey, guys, look, I can do things that you can't, and you can't stop me. Syria is another example. He's done well in Syria. He's had pretty much his own way. He's propped up his man, President Assad. He knows he has more power than the people who might try to stop him.
I'm attempting to be optimistic here, Robin, but is there the possibility...
Good luck with that.
I mean, we've seen Putin do the big statesman-like thing in recent days, or at least last last week of restoring ties with Turkey, with his fellow strongman Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Is there the possibility here of attempting to make another, perhaps magnanimous gesture that in return for, I guess, recognition formally of Russia's annexation of Crimea, which everybody knows will never be reversed, he makes some concession of something he didn't really want anyway?
I don't see it. I mean, you know, as I say, good luck being an optimist on that. And there is another way of reading the whole Turkey rapprochement as well, which is this is another way for Mr. Putin to tweak NATO's tail, to say to the West, hey, you think Mr. Erdogan is your guy? Yes, he's a member of NATO. Yes, in theory, he's helping you in what you want to happen in Syria. But look, I'm being nicer to him than you are. I can offer him things that you can't. You've got to count me into this equation.
Tom, there's also been some peculiar internal politics in Moscow in the last few days. We've seen this strange, weird, obviously scripted television exchange in which Vladimir Putin dismissed his long-serving confrere and chief of staff, Sergei Ivanov. I do enjoy reading between the lines of these things. He's now going to be the special envoy on transport, environment, and conservation. Now, in the context of Putin's Russia, that is a step up from the salt pile, isn't it?
Well, I tell you, maybe if he wants to reconnect with nature, that might be a nice little gig for him. At 63, again, look, he'd like a cushier run. Everybody last week was trying to read the tea leaves, just like we did 20 years ago.
And Kremlinology.
Exactly.
Is this what you do now when you can't airbrush somebody out of the photo of the reviewing stand at the May Day parade?
Well, maybe.
You make them the envoy for the environment.
Put him in charge of the forests. They have a lot of forests.
Why not? Why? They have a lot of forests. And, you know, I guess the latest theory, and there have been a few out there, is that he's just paving the way for the next generation, so getting some younger blood to follow in his path. So maybe that's it. Maybe it's something more sinister. I don't know. We'll have to wait and see.
I'd like to think it's something more sinister. Robin, what have you made of it?
I think it's really hard to know what's going on there. I suspect Tom is right. I think Putin understands that his generation of leaders can't expect to be in charge forever. He knows that in the old Soviet Union, one of the greatest reasons that it fell apart was that it became a nation run by old men who couldn't cope. So he's got to find some new people. We don't really know what's going on inside the Kremlin. We never did, we probably never will. But it's all part of this incredibly opaque jigsaw. Nobody can put the pieces together to make a picture that makes sense.
Okay, well, we should move along to curiously related developments in the US presidential election. It is far from unusual in post-war American history for a bellicose Republican tub-thumper to be associated with accusations of complicity with the Kremlin. However, the GOP blowhard is traditionally the maker of such accusations, not the subject of them. This conventional wisdom, like so many others, has been upended by the campaign of Donald Trump, whose ties to Moscow increasingly appear to reach beyond his peculiar mutual admiration of Vladimir Putin. Tom, the New York Times this weekend reporting nearly $13 million in cash payments to Trump's campaign manager Paul Manafort from the party of Viktor Yanukovych, Putin's placeman in Kiev, as was who Mr. Manafort used to work for. Is this just the inevitable consequence of what happens when you do, as Mr. Manafort has, worked serially for a number of fairly unpleasant people, also including Mobutu in the DRC, or Zaire as then was, and Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines? Or is there something actually weirder going on here?
Today they were saying they're actually comparing signatures. It's down to that level. It could have been a third party that ran away with the $13 million and signed up somebody else's name on the dotted line. We don't know at this stage. And Manafort says, it ain't my money. I wish I had $12.7 million, but he says his take, he didn't get it. So I think we're not there yet. And again, this committee that's looking into this double book, black book, if you will, was set up by money from the EU and from the US. So again, is there any bias involved? I don't know. But it's fascinating to see this play out.
Robin, I was about to ask the question, how strange is this? Which obviously when you apply it to Donald Trump's campaign is, we've only got another 20 minutes. But is there any kind of link that we can see between this and things like Trump's support for the annexation of Crimea, assuming Trump knows where Crimea actually is, Russia's alleged hacking of DNC emails, etc.? Is there a lot of is there just a lot of smoke, or is there a fire somewhere at the bottom of it?
Well, there's a good rule in politics, isn't there, which is follow the money. And when you've got somebody like Mr. Trump, whose claim to fame is that he's a businessman, there's a lot of money swirling around him. And there is no doubt that at various points of his career, a lot of the money came from people who either were Russian or who had interests in Russia. There's a big story in the Financial Times today outlining some of this. Now, as a businessman, he will take the view that the people who make money available to me are people to whom I owe something. They are people who will expect something back. It may be a return on investment. If I become president of the United States, it might take a different form. So, I mean, I don't think it's just people looking for muck. It's a serious issue. Do you have a man here who has such serious financial links with people in Russia, not necessarily with Mr. Putin himself, but people around Mr. Putin, people who, you know, the oligarchs and all of them, then it becomes a serious issue and a serious national security issue.
Well, the novelty here, Tom, is that, as Robin says, the alleged ties to Russia are business-related rather than ideologically related. I don't think anybody accuses Donald Trump of having any particular ideological commitment to anything. But on that serious point that Robin raises right there, is there, given that he is he may not become president, and the polls suggest that he won't, but he's the nominee for president and therefore by tradition entitled to pretty much the same good stuff that the president gets in his intelligence briefings, is there a genuine problem here? Is there a genuine question of national security to be raised over whether Donald Trump should be allowed a free run at the files?
By definition, if you are the nominee of one of the two major parties, that comes with the territory. So if you don't like him, it doesn't matter. He's going to have to get those briefings, even if you think he can't handle the briefings.
But Tom, is it really as much as the really kind of sensitive stuff that the president gets?
I don't think so. I think it's intelligence decaf. I mean, that's my own interpretation of what he's getting. I think he's getting the real deal, but I think he's going to get some insights into exactly where the
lie lies. I mean, if we assume that the Russians are hacking into all kind of stuff anyway, it might very well be that they know more than he's getting in his briefing.
He might get a better deal that way. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, Robin, the thing that strikes me is, I mean, Putin obviously seems, if not enthusiastic about a Trump presidency, then at least, you know, vaguely amused by the prospect. But should he be, given what we know about the direction in which America's missiles are pointed, how relaxed should he be, really?
Oh, my goodness. Let's not go down to where missiles are being pointed and who might actually press the button to launch them. I don't want to go there. But look, Putin hates Hillary Clinton. He holds her responsible for a lot of the sanctions regime. He sees her as somebody who said she wanted to press a reset button when she was Secretary of State, but then didn't follow through. He will go for anybody who is against Hillary Clinton. I assume that if the links between him and Trump are as they are reported to be, he takes the view that he can handle Trump no problem.
Final thought on this one from you, Tom. Again, even if there is no fire beneath the smoke, is any of, and this is a question we've asked ourselves about Trump time and time again, what does he actually have to say or do to actually persuade his supporters that really they can't vote for this man? Is this going to be what sticks? This idea that maybe a man proposing to be president of the United States has uncomfortably close ties with America's great traditional enemy?
Well, again, that has a strong, strong resonance, as you can well imagine, going back decades upon decades in America. If he can somehow show that he has never in his life met with him, there's no email traffic, all of that kind of stuff, evidential.
I think releasing his tax returns.
Well, yes, by releasing his tax returns. Clean version. Yes, that would be...
You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of August, 2016, on Monocle 24.
Very, very important. He would like that to be an on-issue, as you can well imagine. He wants to get back on the forefront and pound like he did last week about the economy and looking at, use Detroit as an example, saying, you think Detroit is great? You think Detroit is great being half the size it was 60 years ago? Do you think that all these streets that are being ripped up are good? Well, then if you want more of the same, it'll be a quarter of the size in 4 years. He can use that as the anti-candidate this time around.
Haven't we got to the point, though, Tom, where it doesn't really matter to Trump's most devoted supporters what he says or does? They just like what they see of him.
You are absolutely right. And that goes also for Hillary. So the big play is maybe that 20% that don't like either of them, that are willing to sit it out. To the younger people, to millennials who are scratching their heads. You look at those numbers. Boy, they are hot. And they're like, They don't like either one. What kind of flips can you do to say, come on board? Neither of them are doing anything right now to get these younger people on board. And that's very, very key and very, very important this year.
Well, on that happy note, we will take a short break. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, Robin Lustig and Tom Rivers. Coming up next, should Australia be concerned by the kind of fans its asylum policy is attracting in Germany?
The Foreign Desk is getting a little brother. The Foreign Desk Explainer. Each week we'll look at one of the world's biggest issues and, well, explain it. The Foreign Desk Explainer is a 5-minute nugget of information, analysis and opinion, and you can download it every week from iTunes, SoundCloud or, of course, Monocle.com. The Foreign Desk Explainer, available right now from Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. I'm Andrew Muller. Still with me are Robin Lustig and Tom Rivers. Now, one of the more persistent refrains of the UK's recent referendum on EU membership was this idea of an Australian-style points-based system for selecting immigrants. One political party in Germany, however, has declared itself enamoured of Australia's methods of discouraging immigrants. Alternative for Deutschland, a somewhat unsavoury anti-immigration populist party, propose interring rejected asylum seekers on islands in the manner Australia does on Manus and Nauru. Robin, first of all, leaving aside the morality or otherwise of such a policy, this strikes me as logistically somewhat daft. Australia has a few hundred, if that, illegal immigrants arriving by boat every year. They are attempting to address an issue of hundreds of thousands of people crossing into a country with immense land borders.
Well, that's one issue. The other issue is, I was looking at a map earlier to try and find some sparsely inhabited islands close to Europe where that nobody there would mind having tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of alleged illegal immigrants dumped on them. There are no such islands. They do not exist. I have no idea where this idea comes from or where it's going.
Well, there is some suggestion in the German media, bewildered as you are by exactly what they mean by this, that they are literally referring to Nauru and Manus.
Oh, now, right, so ship them 10,000 miles away.
Well, Nauru is not exactly convenient, no. Papua New Guinea is closing the camp on Manus anyway. Tom, do you get any sense that Alternative for Deutschland have thought this all the way through?
I don't think they've thought this through at all. I mean, it just seems unworkable. The numbers, the distance. But heck, it may be some traction in the elections.
Is Europe's answer to building a wall between the US and Mexico?
It sounds like it, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, a nice, simple answer to a very difficult question.
Yes, exactly.
Alternative for Deutschland could, of course, make the point that walls have been built across Germany. The last one wasn't terrifically popular.
It was not. Well, and also, walls tend to be breached wherever you put them. They get holes in them. Look, there is a real issue, obviously, and in Germany it is a very real issue, and it becomes electorally very significant. This is one of the daftest ideas I have seen coming out of this debate so far.
Is there an argument, though, Tom, and I'm not wishing to shill for Alternative for Deutschland over here, but is there an argument that Germany was not, certainly last summer, strict enough? It is, I mean, a million people arrived at least last year in Germany.
Yep.
It is beyond any doubt, that a great many of them arrived from places like Macedonia, Kosovo, Albania, places which may not be as prosperous as Germany, but certainly you are under no threat to your life if you live in one of them. Should Germany have taken a more robust approach in the first instance?
Well, I mean, it's wonderful. Hindsight is 2020.
Indeed, so.
And you get thrown, you know, it's like, here comes over a million people, deal with it. It's not like they had the infrastructure in place to rock and roll and to deal with this. They dealt with it as they did. Interesting, today it came out, the individual about 3 weeks ago that it was a failed suicide attempt. He blew himself up outside a beer garden. But apparently, they had done a psychological profile of this guy over a year ago, saying that, look, if you say you're going to deport this guy, he's going to probably lose it. And if that kind of information is swirling around and no one's talking to each other, then you got problems. And the same story about in the bigger picture on those that are rejected for citizenship, then there's going to be some in that basket that they're going to have to deal with very sensitively.
I have to say, though, Andrew, I have enormous admiration for the people of Germany. By and large, they have coped with this influx extraordinarily well, far better than I think the UK, for example, would have done. The same, to a different extent, goes for Italy and Greece, also, which have taken in huge numbers of people, by and large, without problems. The thing about Germany, Mrs. Merkel was right in theory when she said, we need these people. We're not having enough babies. Our population is aging. We need more young people to do the jobs, to pay the taxes. Let's get them in from outside. That is fine. Of course, there are social problems, there are cultural problems, all of which need to be dealt with. But by and large, it seems to me the surprising thing is not how much anti-immigrant feeling there is in Germany, but relatively speaking, how little there is.
But the downside of that is, and you're right in that I think, as is always the way with the news, it tends to magnify actually quite small stories and quite small trends because they're unusual. But AfD, Alternative for Deutschland, now represented in 8 of 16 state houses. They're polling at 11% nationwide, which would certainly see them represented in the national parliament. How big a noise could they become?
Well, I remember when the British National Party, the BNP, here was polling something like 11% in some parts of England. They went away, they disappeared. Look, Germany has a history. We all know what Germany's history is. The resurgence of an extreme nationalist, extreme xenophobic party in Germany, of course, is concerning. It seems to me, as long as the economy remains relatively stable, as long as most people stay in work, still have homes, still can send their kids to school, then it's going to be handleable. But it needs to be handled carefully.
And just finally on this one, Tom, Australia's hard line, whatever you think about it, and I'm not sure what I think about it myself as an Australian, but the argument always made in its favour, and it does seem fairly irrefutable, that since the extremely hard line was introduced, the boats have stopped coming, and that has meant people have stopped drowning. Is there an argument that you do actually save lives by displaying a more, rugged approach, at least in the short term?
Wow, that's a great question. Again, what gets the headlines if somebody decides to commit suicide or something of that nature while they're in their holding island, if you will? That's what grabs the headlines. And what can you do for an alternative? Do the boats stop? I guess you're right in that regard. So you take with one hand and you give with the other.
And some of them may be dying in Afghanistan. We don't see the ones who die in Afghanistan from disease, from illness, from bombs falling on them. When they die on a boat, often we are aware of what has happened. Not always, but often. When they die at home, whether it's in Syria or in Afghanistan or in Somalia or in Yemen or in Eritrea, it's invisible. We don't see it. And what scares me and worries me and upsets me is that I think we prefer it that way. We prefer them to die where we can't see them. What we don't like is that they die on our shores. That upsets us.
Indeed. So, well, finally tonight, the Rio Games have reminded us, as Olympic tournaments always do, that for every gesture of fraternity, there's an expression of hostility. For every photo op between North and South Korean gymnasts, an Egyptian judoka refusing the handshake of his Israeli opponent. This being the case, pity the director of the Olympic Village, responsible for assigning quarters to all 200-odd visiting delegations, ideally without starting World War III. Now, the person in question, we know who he is. His name is Mario Salenti. He's profiled in a very funny piece in the New York Times this weekend. Tom, where would you even start?
Exactly.
The temptation to have fun with this, if you were him or if I were him, and I think it's just as well for the Olympic movement that I am not, because seriously, the fun you could have.
You could have a heck of a lot of fun. And this is fascinating. I just had my eldest daughter get married last month, and it was like putting together the wedding breakfast. And you can't put Uncle Lenny with Auntie Lucy because, you know, it's the same
but
deal.
But you didn't have 18,000 guests.
You don't have that either. But I love it. The first dibs is Brazil. And then you work with the big pieces. I guess you work with the U.S.'s and the China's. And then you kind of put in other little pieces that want to be together or reject each other like opposite ends of a magnet. So it's, I guess there's a magic formula, but you got to work at it.
But you know what I loved most about that piece? And it was a lovely article. I read it too in the New York Times. The one thing that this guy said, he really gave him problems was not to do with the politics of this country doesn't like that country. Mm-hmm. It was to do with the number of delegations who said they didn't want to be close to other delegations from the Caribbean or from Latin America because their music was too loud. That's what mattered. It wasn't war. It wasn't history. It was keeping me awake at night.
Get the room in the hotel in the back. Always
exactly,
when you're on
not
the
above
road.
The kitchen.
Exactly.
No. That is basic foreign correspondent law. You always ask for room away from the street. One, because it's quieter, and also there's the car bombs issue.
It could be safer. Exactly.
In certain locations. So I have a vague memory that the Mustafa Guesthouse in Kabul used to charge extra for rooms away from the street for exactly that reason. Though I could be making that up.
Well, but at the Kabul Hotel in Beirut, they used to say, "Do you want street side, which is car bombs, or the back of the hotel, which is mortar shells?"
There are of course serious security issues. In fact, unbelievable security mm-hmm. issues in this day and age with organizing an Olympic Village. One of the other details in the article, Tom, is that the U.S. delegation have not done the thing of hanging their national flag off every balcony.
Right.
Doesn't that in itself make them a target, though?
Maybe by definition.
Sure,
it does.
Well, I was just thinking, shouldn't they do what? This is something I can remember back years and years ago when I was being an annoying Australian with a backpacker in Europe. A fun game to play was whenever you saw somebody with a Canadian flag on their backpack, was just to go up to them and ask them which part of the states they were from.
Okay, exactly. I remember that.
You got a lot of lifts that way, I'm sure.
You know, maybe it's a sign of the times and what we live in. But, you know, the first time I saw the pictures last week and some of these balconies and flags, and the light bulb went off and I go, security, I wonder why they put up those flags. And I guess that's been the policy of the U.S. team. And
well,
don't put the flags up.
But the Americans should just hang huge Canadian flags off their buildings.
Well, maybe.
Their buildings.
But there wasn't very much in the story about security, was there? I was just wondering about the security around the tower block, which had the 900 Americans in it. I mean, who is around the bottom of that tower block?
Well, it is extraordinary. There is also the, as they also say that, harking back to Munich in 1972, the Israelis learnt the hard way the world learnt the hard mm-hmm. way what happens when you don't secure it properly. The Israelis, again, also don't hang their flag off the building. Interesting sideline in that same article, the Israeli delegation were very quick to say they made no specific requests at all about whom they were put next to.
There are quite a lot of stories, aren't there, that the athletes themselves actually get on very well with each other, regardless of what the politics are of their various governments. You can see that the official delegations, the government leaders, they might have problems. But when it comes to the actual athletes, with one or two exceptions, as you said, in the judo between the Israeli and the Egyptian, but by and large, the athletes themselves mm-hmm. seem to muddle along pretty well.
It's often the case with rival politicians and indeed even often rival soldiers. They actually get
absolutely.
On. They actually
absolutely.
Get on
that's
entirely
a great point,
well.
Exactly. Yeah. And they get on, although their bosses may be at loggerheads, yeah. they on a certain yeah. level have a commonality. Exactly.
Have either of you been struck, and I'll ask you first, Robin, by any sort of especially exciting or entertaining diplomatic subtext at these games?
I haven't come across any diplomatic subtext. I mean, I always have, because I'm an Englishman, I always go for the underdog. And I was particularly thrilled when I saw a tennis player, female tennis player from Puerto Rico, win the final and win Puerto Rico's first ever gold medal at the Olympics. And I just thought, yes, that's what I really like to see. I mean, I'm delighted, of course, that Team GB has won however many gold medals it is at this exact moment that we're talking. They probably won another couple since we came into the studio. I don't know.
Okay.
But I mean, yeah, I like it when the little guys do well.
Well, speaking as an Australian, of course, I have no interest in the underdogs. I'm only interested in seeing the green and gold crushing our opposition like bugs. There hasn't been nearly enough of that for my life. And Britain are winning far too many gold medals. Tom, anything on this front leapt out at you?
Nothing diplomatically. I just think that the moment for me thus far is Mo Farah after falling down, and then he wins. He wins the gold. That's a movie right there. I love it. That's fantastic.
Yeah. Also, watching Andy Murray at the end of their tennis match overnight, you understand that no matter how fit these guys are, however good they are, boy, does it take it out of them.
Oh, God,
he could barely put one foot separate.
But that match itself was an illustration of what we were talking about. I mean, there was clearly enormous respect between the two men, mm-hmm. but almost an outbreak of actual tennis hooliganism in the crowd. I mean, obviously, Argentina and Britain, there's
an amount of history.
There's an amount of history.
As do Brazil and Argentina.
Well, Brazilian fans dressed up like Scotsmen for that game. I enjoyed particularly as well. On that happy cross-cultural note, that is all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks to our guests, Tom Rivers and Robin Lustig. The show was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Molly Ingleby. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. There's more music next with Carlotta. At 1900, it's The Culture Show with Robert Bound, and there'll be more on the day's main stories. On The Daily at 2200, I'll also be your host for that. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.